Welcome to another episode of the Peak Performance Selling Podcast, where we interview top sellers and sales leaders to learn the different tips, tricks, and mental strategies that they use to create sustainable peak performance. Let's get rolling. Welcome to today's episode of the Peak Performance Selling Podcast. Today's guest is really exciting. I got introduced to him by another guest, David Meerman Scott, who has a close connection to Brent Keltner, who is a PhD and founder and president of Winalytics LLC. They're a go-to-market and revenue acceleration consultancy. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, The Revenue Acceleration Playbook, which I've had a chance to dig into a little bit and I'm super excited for. And at Winalytics, they help clients reach their top growth potential by shifting from product-driven conversations to authentic conversations that anchor on what each buyer and customer values most. As you can all probably guess already, we're going to dig into authenticity a little bit. But Brent has a really cool background, and he'll tell us a little bit more about it. But before starting Winalytics, he spent more than a decade as a revenue leader in enterprise to early stage companies, including Kaplan, EduVentures, Plus Delta Partners, and Collegiate Link. He began his career as a PhD social scientist and spent 10 years conducting qualitative research interviews at Stanford and the Rand Corporation. So he's got a really unique perspective on sales, on leadership, on late stage, large scale organizations to earlier stage ventures. So I'm really excited to learn from Brent today and how we can think about mindset and performing at our best as sales and sales leaders. Welcome, Brent.
Hey, Jordan. Thanks for having me here. I'm really looking forward to the conversation.
I'm excited as well, as we got a chance to connect beforehand. And as I got a chance to dig into a little bit of an early excerpt copy of the book, I think there is so much opportunity there. And so as we start out, I'm always curious, help us understand about your journey as an early seller, which I know you referenced a little bit in the book, leading sales organizations, the point now at Winalytics, really working across go-to-market and revenue teams. How'd you get there? And what have been some impactful moments that really changed the way you view the world or changed the way that you operate?
Yeah, the pivot point for me, as I talk about in the first chapter of the book, was when I joined EduVentures after a year at Kaplan, just over a year, which was an awesome learning experience. EduVentures was my first true revenue leadership role, where I had a chance with another executive on the team to launch a benchmarking research practice to colleges and universities. Started to grow a team, a sales, marketing, the whole thing, customer success team. And so I reached out to all my business colleagues. I had come from academics, as you said, and said, hey, I need stuff on go-to-market strategy, positioning strategy, sales. And they gave me a bunch of resources that said customer and buyer, but it was all about the product and positioning the product and pricing and the competitive battle cards on the product. And I was like, where the hell's the customer in this, right? And so I literally went back to, you mentioned I had been a qualitative researcher at Rand, and I was raised by educators, and the corporate world seemed really strange. So I very intentionally built corporate behaviors. Right. So I thought, OK, well, I got to tell these people, I was doing benchmarking research projects with banking, insurance companies, telecoms, other commercial sectors. What's in it for them? Very explicit in the email. What's in it for them? What's the value in terms of why they want to have the conversation? I would recap in the conversations what I heard you say, you know, what you were working on around your training, learning and development conversation. Then I'll always say, hey, if there's a next step I'm going to take with your team, follow up email, document all that, be very quick to socialize peers we were working with. So I had done that to be commercial, right? And in reality, what I had done is create what we now call an authentic buyer journey. It's not about me or my product. It's about you and how you can get the most out of working together. And when I just saw it at EduVentures, I just went straight back to what I had learned. And I now, rather than research methodology, I turned it into a sales methodology and had four very quick growth successes. And then I said, hey, there's a method to this madness, and I can start a consulting firm and teach others to do that. And that's what Winalytics does.
That's great. I think it's really interesting too, especially as I think about my interactions with education organizations as a whole that don't really think they sell, but totally sell, and how they approach things. And so I hear this word authenticity come up a lot. And I feel that's actually one of the biggest challenges in business today is that the historic employee was one person at home and a totally different person at the office or in the sales conversation. And so I'm curious, like, what does authenticity mean to you? And maybe what are people missing about that in today's sales leadership and selling environment?
Yeah, I mean, so I think often people hear authenticity and they say, oh, you're a nice person. One of the best worst compliments I ever got from a direct report is Brent is tough, but fair. And that to me, an authenticity in a way is about a intentional conversation that is us co-deciding and co-developing together whether there's a there. We talk about fit all the time. And to me, authenticity isn't a nice guy or I'm going to bend over or a nice gal, I'm going to bend over and do anything you ask. It's more about there's two sides of this conversation. And the more I am anchored on what you care about, not my product, but what you care about and whether I can make a match and whether we can make a match together, that's authenticity. There is one story I think might help from the book. Interviewed a senior revenue leader at Hertz, Avis Hertz, and Beth Kinnerk. And she started that interview by saying, you know, if we're competing on price, that's our problem. They're in a commodity market. They're kind of selling institutional contracts for car rentals, right? But they have developed a set of technology workflow that can lead to a better user experience for their road warriors, save them time, save money on the billing side of things, bill splitting workflows, et cetera. So what she teaches her team is it's all about co-developing together what their definition of success is. If they're thinking lowest cost, great, not a fit for us. But if they're thinking, how can I make my road warriors travel easier, save them time, let them get on to their productive business? How can I, on the back end, make it easier for everybody to submit their bills? If they're thinking in those terms, in a more of a value-added exchange, then together we can build what is the business case to partnering. And so they very intentionally go through, do you see value around saving your road warriors time, around letting them get to their business, you know, a series of steps that's cutting out. They don't have to stop at the counter. They don't have to check out, right? They can check in from the hotel room. They can split their bills. Do you see value in that? If you see value, okay, let's build together what the value case is. So now you're having an authentic conversation. It's direct. It's intentional. It's is there 1 + 1 = 3 in us partnering together?
It's really interesting because I think historically, and you talk about this a little in the book, is, you know, sales was so one-sided in the past. It was all about the seller. It was all about the company and what they're trying to sell. And as we move to this more mutually beneficial relationship and engagement that gets created, we can show up, be a little bit more transparent as a seller. Hey, I'm here to sell you a product, but I talk to a lot of folks and I'm like, and if you don't stick for, you know, 12, 18, 24, 36 months, like, it's not really success for us on our side of things as I look at it as a company. And so if you can open up that transparency and know that, yes, I am in sales. I tell that to a lot of people on calls. It's like, yeah, I'm in sales. So take me for what I'm worth here. But here's why I'm here and why I believe in what I sell and why I believe that this can be the solution for you. And if it's not, I'm happy to tell you, because getting to a no, if we're not aligned in what we want to achieve, is a great thing in sales too.
100%. And I mean, the people talk a lot about the trusted advisor model in selling now, where it's not about me selling you or closing you. but it's about introducing an opportunity for partnering. And I think it's exactly what you just said is, you know, increasingly sales is a hard job. And if you don't believe in the mission of what you're doing, it's hard to do, but not everybody is a good fit for you. So if we're intentionally saying, look, I believe strongly in what we're doing, I'm excited about, could be a video platform, you know, that helps you create video, high quality video to engage people. It could be a better travel experience. It could be a degree program. If you believe in that, then you're just presenting opportunities to take advantage of the value that your product or solution unlocks. Not everybody's going to see that, and that's okay. Because the reality, and this is one of the things we coach around, is you start with questions about what your buyer values, but then you end with, and we think of a three-part meeting, you map to what they value. And then the third part is, and what actions will they take to unlock the value, right? It's not what I will do, what will they do? And when you first ask people to think about their deals that way, 30% of their deals are in drift. Because I never ask people to do anything, right? So it's a two-way street. Like, not everybody's a good fit, as you said, and the sooner you figure that out, the better.
From what sense?
I'm not pestering you, and you're not wasting my time with follow-up calls where you're just kicking the tires.
I think there's so much truth to that, because one, sales is hard. I think we all can resonate and relate to that. And two, the quicker we can get to a no, the more opportunity we have to get to that next yes. And I think there's a lot of power in that, especially as we think about in so many organizations today where, yeah, there may be an initial foot in the door, but then there's opportunity to upsell, cross-sell new products, add additional value over time. And so we need to find these long-term relationships opposed to, you know, just selling the used car off the lot and then you're, you know, done with it. And go far away.
Well, just one quick, I love how you said, I once heard a sales leader say the second best answer is no. Because then, as you said, great. I can move on to the next yes, maybe is not great. I want to get a yes or a no.
I got a prospect that I've been working on for a while that's been, they've said yes 100 times and then keep kicking the tires. And I'm like, will you just please tell me no at this point in time? Like, I would just rather not. I looked at the email today. There's at least 50 emails on a chain. And you're like, I just would rather you tell me no at this point in time, opposed to teasing me with false yeses. I'm like, I'm a grown up. I can take a no. I won't cry, I promise. So I love it. I'm curious, as we talk about like sales, being a trusted advisor, I hear you from a corporate perspective that, you know, a lot of corporations, I think, get it wrong because they only talk about themselves. What do individuals or sales leaders, do you think, get wrong about that trusted advisor status, or really putting themselves in that position to be a trusted advisor?
I think people can get it wrong. I mean, I do think one basic shift in selling people have is it's reciprocal, right? I'm not here to serve you and I'm not here to sell you anything. And so I think people can hear that, much like people hear challenger sale and they say, I have to challenge my prospect. I have to wrestle them down to the ground. And trusted advisor is like, I'm an advisor to you. And I just always want to bring people back to, it's in the fit. It's in the alignment, whatever you want to call it. It's in the 1+1=3. That I think people can go off track. So a trusted advisor is basically like, I'm going to introduce you to things that can move you forward, but I need to ask you back whether you see those as moving you forward or not.
I like that, especially as the challenger sale has come up so much in the past. And I think it's started to get almost a bad rap a little bit, because people think they just need to be this aggressive person. And I love the trusted advisor more, because I do think a challenger is somebody that is there to help give you advice, to help show you new opportunities or think about things in a way that you haven't done it. But I've seen a lot of people try to implement that sales strategy and just come off kind of as an asshole.
Yeah. And I mean, I think what people got wrong about the Challenger, what's great about it is let me lead with challenges. People will lean into that. And so as a response to all this consultative selling, I questioned you to death. Right. And so that was the early versions. I just questioned you to death, and prospects get, you know, you got four or five questions before you need a pocket of energy. And so I think what was really transformational, what they said is, don't just ask these stupid situational questions, like put a challenge out there. How are you working on this? And what if? So I think that's great. But I think you're right, as people then get it to get a little bit more aggressive about, rather than, you know, I've got three challenges we can have a conversation about. It's, what do you mean you don't have that challenge? And so they get into a challenging mode rather than, you know, kind of engaging you around your challenges.
I like that. And the advising, and I think that's where we can add value as sellers today, as organizations, when we can actually give advice. Most of us have more perspective than anybody that's inside of their own business doing their own thing. If we can say, hey, I've talked to 500, 5,000 other people like you, here's some ideas that other people are doing, or here's some ways other people are approaching it. Now we're actually adding value in that process and being an advisor. So I really like that, and this thought that it's reciprocal. You know, we're here to give, we're here to help, we're here to advise, and not just try and take as quickly as possible.
Yeah. And I love the way you brought that up. Like, I think often we do appreciate our expertise when we sell a product, because look, I'll often say to teams we work with, you got to remember that you do this all day long. Your buyer might source this once a year, once every 2 years, twice a year. And so don't underestimate the extent to which you can pattern recognize for them and recommend a solution forward. And people love that. When you project manage for them, like, hey, based on what I've heard, here's some other similar companies we've worked with. Do any of those seem aligned with for you, right, on how they solve that problem? Demonstrating expertise. And then typically when we get to this point in this conversation, this is what we recommend you do next. And sometimes people are a little bit sheepish, or that's too pushy. And I'm like, no, the opposite. You're like, you can't demand it. But if you suggest the next step, often people will commit to it, and you can just hear the energy on the prospect side. Hey, great. Looking forward to that next conversation. And I've seen it again and again and again, where people won't ask, make a recommendation on the next step, and then won't ask for the next step. And when they shift and say, I think we should do this next because of what I heard, are you okay with putting time on our calendar 2 weeks? 80-90% of the time, the prospect is thrilled. They're like, hey, somebody is managing this part of my life for me. So totally huge part of the trusted advisor model is we have expertise, which we can bring to our advisors on the right next step of the conversation. They're not saying yes to a signed contract. They're saying, yes, I will take that step to see if there is fit on both sides. That's a great insight.
This is really good. And so talk to me a little bit about the mental game maybe that you play for yourself as you think about, you know, how do you show up seeing these teams that have done really well that you've grown and worked on this stuff, and some that, you know, have struggled to adopt it. What have you had to do for yourself mentally, or mindset that you've had to bring to the table to really help perform at your best?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting is I think what we've gotten better at is gauging the mindset of the teams that we may engage with. We were just on a conversation earlier today with a CEO. This is a kind of an emerging growth team, you know, just under 2 million in revenue. And it's kind of one of our sweet spots, 2 to 5 million. And the mindsets, right, that you talk about to be successful, we find in the methodology we teach, is it's collaborative leadership, right? Somebody has to, you want to collaborate with your team, but somebody's got to lead. And the other part of it is just what we say. I get this question all the time is CEOs or CROs or whoever says, well, tell us more when you are and aren't successful. And basically what I say is, if your team is open to learning from their customers and from each other actively, right? And no, and willing to do that, we will not fail. But if they don't have that mindset, and everybody says they have a growth mindset, so I just say, okay, point to me two talk tracks or questions you've taken from a teammate. How often does that happen, right? And does your team actually actively collaborate and share those practices and borrow from each other? So if they have that mindset, we will not fail. And so it's interesting you say our preparation is gauging the mindset out of the gate, because we do sometimes get, we started to gauge the leadership, whether it's the sales leader or the company leadership, depending on the size of the company. Like, are you in that mindset where you want your team to actively collaborate, build the best playbooks together? Great. Is your team in that mindset? Because we get into these engagements and you have a bunch of arm folders and bomb throwers, right? And it sucks. I mean, you put all this work into building these playbooks and working with the team, and everybody's looking for, you know, how to trip you up. And so a lot of our prep work is understanding the mindsets to be successful, and really just gauging that and being intentional, saying, hey, yeah, all revenues is more revenue is good, but not if it's the not, if it's not the right revenue. And looking for, we haven't done this 100 times, we've done dozens of times, but we still want every customer to be a win that we can reference.
Really interesting. And there's a quote that I love that I've probably shared a few times for listeners on this podcast, but it's from Daniel Goleman, who was kind of one of the founders on emotional intelligence. And he talks about the electricity or the energy from a leader flows through the rest of the team like electricity through wires. And so if you have that leadership team that's not bought in, that's not open, that's not collaborative, I can see where it would be tough. And I'd be interested to then hear on one of my favorite questions that I love to ask guests, as you work with a lot of leaders, and you just touched on a little bit, but what are some of those qualities that you really love in leaders that you've worked with, or that maybe you even try and emulate as you lead teams?
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously, you know, good leaders have to be inspirational and empathetic and good communicators and all that stuff. And there's people that would be better qualified than me to talk about good leadership. But with go-to-market leadership, I think one of the things that I think of is true of great leaders is the commitment to practice. And it sounds strange to say that, but, you know, we sometimes in engagements will say to teams that haven't made that commitment yet, if you followed a sports team, you followed your local baseball team or your local football team, and they didn't have a playbook, how serious would you think they were? And if they didn't practice the playbook, or if practice was optional for some players, how serious would you think they were? And we just make the point that many go-to-market teams never practice. They show up for their calls. They write down their plays, maybe, but they never practice their plays in team-based sessions, whether it's call reviews. We have teams that use call reviews, or teams that do look at emails, activator dealer solutions. They review emails. How well did you capture the buyer payoff statement, our aligned capabilities, our success stories, and what we're going to do about it next? One client I loved, Mainstay, where they had something they modeled on the Navy SEALs, after action reviews. And one person was on the hot spot, right, weekly or biweekly for a call review. CEO would participate in these, and they had a framework for how they wanted to run those calls. And it was just practicing discovery questions, talk tracks, success stories. How do you manage objections? How do you make sure all the stakeholders, so different things they're practicing. But that commitment to practice makes the difference between good and excellent. And so I always like to, I just like to compare notes with people on how do you commit your team to practice? Because when you practice, what you're saying is, I'm going to enable you to be the best you you can be. And I'm also going to hold you accountable for being the best you you can be. So I love to hear stories about practice, both as a team, but then individually, the team creates that accountability. The individual practice really allows you to sharpen your skills. What are the two things you can do to achieve your top performance?
Oof, this is really good. I'm glad you gave some of the after-action review example as well, because I think so many people go to run call reviews, but again, don't have a playbook for that or a framework on how to do it effectively. And they say, hey, let's listen to this hour-long call and like see if we can unpack the whole thing. And I find that to be highly ineffective if we can't have a little bit of a framework beyond that. But so I get it. Like sitting down, reviewing calls, doing these things is obviously going to make me better. Any professional sports team, to your point, they watch film, even though, and you're in Boston now, even though you're California originally, I saw a video from Gronkowski today from Gronk saying, yeah, I never watch any video. I just go to Tom Brady and ask him, like, who's covering me? What's going on? And I just go to Tom because he watches all the video. But I find in sales, as we're driving towards this quota, as there's always work that could be done, as the sales leader needs to see an impact on maybe a monthly quota, that a lot of people really struggle to actually carve out that time for the practice, for the review, for the film club, or whatever it might be. And so how do you handle that when you're talking to other go-to-market leaders and revenue leaders about really making sure there's a dedication and commitment to that practice and the value of it, even though it's taking many people off of the direct activity of selling right then?
Yep. It's a great question. And what we get trying to get in people's head is think about an hour a week. It's 3% of your working week that is dedicated to skills practice, either in an individual coaching call or a team coaching call. And we alternate those. It's an hour a week, right? 3% of your time to get better at what you do, not to just close the deals, but to shift the arc. And I think the reality in my experience is that is enough time if you do it repetitively to shift the trajectory. And you said one thing that is hugely important, which is a key to successful coaching. We call it a core skills matrix, but it's a team agreeing together. You know, what are the six or eight things that in our role that we need to be really good at, right? And then agreeing when we do call reviews, let's focus on two. How did I open the meeting? How did I do good value discovery? How quickly did I get to a buyer success statement? Or how did I close the meeting? Did I intentionally say at the end, you know, hey, we got 10 minutes left. We're coming at a time. I want to talk about where you see fit the most value and what we do about it next. And in that, did you go through that next call? Who's going to be on it? Why? Right. So how do I close the meeting? Right. Or how do I do what you talked about, sharing the right success story? So you as a team, and we do this with teams, it's like, what are the things you have to focus on? And then agree to focus on a couple. Don't focus on everything. Focus on a couple. When you're doing individual coaching, focus on a couple until you both feel comfortable or as a team that we're doing better there. And then you move on to the next one. So that focus on, you know, a couple of things that are going to take our game to the next level, hugely important to actually make an impact. So an hour a week, couple skills to focus on, makes it a lot more manageable.
That makes it a lot more. 3%. That's not that much.
3%. I mean, round up, maybe it's 2 hours a week, 6%, but it's we're talking about a fraction of your time to get better. I mean, I had a team recently where some of the top performers were sort of resistant and not, they were showing up the team calls, turning off the videos, and, you know, not showing up or constantly moving their one-on-one calls. And so I gave them the talk tracks I gave them were this, hey, if you followed a sports team that didn't have a playbook, that didn't practice, that how to, it's like, So you got to practice, and we're talking about 3 to 5% of your time.
Can we continue? I like that a lot. I think there's a lot of power to that, and it makes it a little less scary in my eyes. So I really like that one a lot. And so as a leader, as somebody that's led teams, that's, you know, leading organizations, what are the routines or habits that you have outside of work to really help you be successful and show up at your best?
Yeah, for me, you know, we are very active in our church, right? So I'm a person of faith. Prayer and meditation, for me, I start the day with prayer. I try and end the day 5 days a week with meditation. And for those that don't consider themselves a person of faith, I would still encourage, it's all kinds of secular meditation or Buddhist meditation, but transformational. In terms of being able to center your energy and creativity, it's amazing how much more productive I have come and be able to figure out my center and my focus. So that's one I would, you know, it's powerful for me. I'd recommend for anybody. And then the other thing is, for me, I just got to work out. I have to get in, you know, 3 or 4 workouts a week. I do karate with my kids, which makes it now a fun kind of work. Well, fun for me, maybe not for them, but so I got to work out. And I think the third thing I would just say is I start every day thinking about what's my heavy lift for the day. And I try and get it done early on in the day or as much as I can before the day starts. And then I seed it through the day. I think those are kind of my three strategies for managing my activities and managing stress.
I think those are perfect. I think as we talk about, you know, healthy mind, body, spirit is critical. And if we're missing on any of those areas, it's really tough. And regardless, I believe, of anybody's religious perspectives, having faith in something is going to be hard to be in sales if you don't have faith in something, whether it's yourself or higher power, whatever it may be, because sales can be tough. Sales, we're more often than not getting no's versus the yes versus the victories. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to not only have faith, but to your point, practice it as well, because things get tough. And I always love asking folks, like, I'm sure you've probably seen like one failure in your career at some point in time or one thing not go super well. And so how do you bounce back from, you know, the bad engagement, the failure, the bad month? What are things that you do to really help yourself bounce back or find more of that success in your next at bat?
I wish it was just one failure. I think I've learned over time. I think maybe the key to success is standing back up after your failures. Because I certainly have a litany of those, you know, false starts and trying to start different software endeavors. I think for me, and I think back to just the pandemic, and, you know, we lost 40% of revenue month to month, like literally in weeks. And it was pretty shocking and terrifying, you know, like, are we going to have to let people go or, you know, go under, and just, is this going to continue? I think often I find just the power of reflection, right? And just this kind of getting out of the head noise of everything going on around that and, you know, thinking more about what actually happened, like what was successful on that? Because even a bad experience, they say, you know, a door closes when a window opens, or the opposite. What was the bad in that? What was the good in that? And just being a little bit more, you know, what can I learn from that? So that for me is reflecting on what happened and then trying to figure out what was a successful element of that, or what was the learning and how can I double down on that? So the pandemic experience, for me, we actually shed a lot of business, but it was actually the least profitable business for us. It was our earlier stage. We're doing more embedded kind of fractional stuff and how to just get rid of it. And it forced our own growth shift to just doing much more work that was on the consulting playbook, process development, coaching. And, you know, so by Q4, we were actually, the revenue footprint was bigger than it had been in Q1 after the Q2 dip, and more profitable. And so I always think of that kind of reflection and then refinement as, you know, after you nurse the wound, what can be helpful.
Yeah. I mean, if any of us didn't get back up learning to walk, none of us would walk, but yet somehow it's so easy to get stuck in this. Oh, I can't do it. I struggle with this all the time. It's something that I think many of us struggle with, but that key that you said in there, I really, really believe in, is pick yourself back up, get going again, and keep moving forward. And thinking back to, yeah, if I was a kid, I wouldn't have learned anything if that one fall, all right, I'm done, no more. And I think there's so much of that that we don't see in today's day and age. We were talking earlier about, you know, social media. We see all the success stories. We all think that, oh, it's just that easy to be Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos. And they've fallen on their face probably more times than many of us combined. Mm. And that is what then takes them to be so successful. So I really love that reflection and then refinement to think about, okay, let's take a look at it. What can we learn? What maybe doors or windows have opened from this now that create new possibility that wasn't there before? And keep on moving. I think that's really great.
And I would take one other thing out of what you just said, which is, I think sometimes when you go through that, people that can't get out of the, stuck out of the mode, it's because they're not open to doing something different, right? So what you said, sort of, there might be a new option that emerges, and you have to commit to say, I haven't done this before, but I'm going to try it this time.
I don't think salespeople ever have that mindset of like, I'm not doing anything new or different. Never. And so one other question before I hit you with a couple rapid fire questions here is, when we were talking before, you know, we talked about, you know, writing a book and really working through narratives and stories. And I think you shared a really cool story with us at the start about, you know, it hurts, and how I think you mentioned Beth was her name, you know, really helped saying like, how do we work on this together? How do we solve for our customer versus just solving for ourselves? And I think in writing a book, as humans, we learn through stories. We learn the best through a story, through a narrative. And so talk to me about, how have you tried to update or maybe have a new somewhat communication style as you've gone to think about actually writing something that I'm guessing is going to be with the intention for the consumer, for the customer, versus you're just writing, talking about yourself the whole time.
Yeah, it's a great example of being able to model now one of the things we just talked about. So you know, from the earlier interview, I was trained as an academic, very analytical writer. I got to write a business book now, and I have a book coach, David Meerman Scott, who introduced us, who is like, you got to start with narratives because people are going to be bored like crazy with your frameworks, which are really great, by the way, but they're going to fall asleep on sentence two. Right. And so that was painful. Right. It's like, what do you mean my frameworks aren't any good? What do you mean you don't want my citations? You want me to be the expert. Right. And so there I had to commit to saying, hey, the old way is not going to work for this new goal. And honestly, I needed a coach. I couldn't have done it on my own. And this is where any salesperson or sales leader, you do have the opportunity for an internal or external coach. It's like, hey, I want to model myself on somebody who might have a different set of practices. And I have to be open to taking their style and integrating with mine. So, you know, I just work with David on how do you write stories? And the first one sucked, you know. And then over time, we got a little bit stories that started with conflict, right? Sucked the reader in, and a little bit of context on the person you're talking to and some meaningful information about their background or meaningful information about how their background said something about them. And so now you've got engagement, you know, some reader engagement. So over time, we just, you know, sculpted kind of the writing with narrative. And then you get to the framework, which now people can digest. And it's a much more powerful way of writing. And honestly, now one I enjoy. It's much more accessible, but it was definitely a new skill for me. And so I needed to be open to doing things different, acknowledging the past wasn't the future and that I needed some mentorship and guidance. And now for me, Jordan, the next hurrah is public speaking around this book launch. I love facilitation in groups of up to 30 or 40. I hate standing up in front of 200 people and being the sage on the stage, but that's the next horizon. So now I'm going to a public speaking course with some people that are really talented, and I'll learn the next set of skills, you know?
It's so fascinating hearing some of this weave through the conversation where you yourself are saying, hey, I've got to be open to doing things differently. I have to look at doing things from a new way and a new perspective. Because so frequently the easy path is to not challenge ourselves. I struggle with this as I look at, you know, my day-to-day and what I'm doing. As I'm like, man, I've had the same job for like 7 years now. This is crazy. Like I got to shift and do something else to shake myself out of those easy habits and routines. And that's where so much growth comes from. That's where so much opportunity comes from. And so I would challenge any of our listeners to think about, you don't have to quit your job. You don't have to go for something totally different, but how do you put yourself in a different mindset? How do you challenge yourself and say, I might fall at this. I might fail completely. And that's okay, because we're going to learn, we're going to grow, and we're going to have new skills at the end of it that we didn't have coming into it at the start. So I love hearing you say, yeah, I'm open to getting a coach and getting feedback and taking seminars and working with people that, one, have different perspective, have different life experience than you, but two, also maybe have spent more time in a certain area so they can really help you say, here are some things that I fell on my face on the first, for me, oh yeah, here's where I stumbled on the podcast, the first 20, 30, 40, 50 episodes, now episode 60, 70. I still stumble through some things, but they're a little bit different now, hopefully, and you're growing and developing. So I just love hearing that mindset and that opportunity that you bring to the table and come back to stories. I just think that is so powerful. So thanks for sharing that.
Cool.
Last couple questions for you. Do you love winning or dislike losing more?
That's a great question. I've never thought about that. I don't know the answer. I know I'm hyper-competitive. I was a hyper-competitive kid. Lost, unfortunately, but I could not stand to lose. I'm not sure even the glow of winning. I hated to lose. So I think I don't like to lose.
Sounds pretty adamant on that answer. I love that. That for me was one of my favorite interview questions I ever got. And I don't think there's a wrong or right answer.
That's a great question. I've never heard that before.
I love it. I love your answer too. It's, I think we just got to see how we can make sure you can still be competitive in something here. Maybe it's going to be in this speaking course. Last one. What does success mean to you today?
I'm a Christian, so there's only one measure of success, and it's kind of bringing our, I have a relationship with God that I want to bring into the world. And what I love about the direction of the book and the company is that I think authenticity, it's a Christian value, right? That we serve each other. And so the idea of bringing that into a business practice, I'm a very competitive dude, to be able to bring those into alignment is pretty powerful to me, to say, and I'm doing something right.
I love it. This thought of, how do you show up for others? How do you serve others? How do you bring that to the world is one, what I think our world needs a lot more of from individuals and people. And two, it creates these more symbiotic relationships that have mutual wins, mutual victories in them versus I'm just here solving for myself, solving for number one to be number one. I don't care what happens to anybody else. So Brent, I think that's really, really wonderful. Last piece, where should folks find you, follow you, We'll obviously link to the book. When's that coming out? When can we expect that? Help me understand how our folks can get in touch with you and connect with you.
Yeah, the easiest thing to remember is authenticitywins.com. So set up a URL, easy to remember, that points back to our book website. It will eventually become the book landing page. So authenticitywins.com. Take you right to our website, winalytics.com. The book comes out in April, but you can pre-order it on Amazon today for anybody that's interested.
Awesome. I can't wait to let folks check out the full thing, for me as well, as I've gotten a chance to read some of it. As I think there are some really good nuggets in there for leaders, for teams, as they think about really building this go-to-market engine, being able to show up authentically for them, their best selves. Think about committing to practice. I think that's a really helpful thing that I took away from today that I know I can use some more of, and being okay stumbling, falling, struggling, as that gives us the opportunity to open a new door, see new possibilities that we haven't seen before.
100%. I would just add, I mean, this mind, body, spirit, I think authenticity begins with a commitment to the life of the spirit, right? Whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist, or you mentioned higher power, and I have family experience with addiction, so I've spent time in Al-Anon. They speak about a higher power. I don't care what your faith tradition or spiritual tradition is. If you commit to one, you're the power of authenticity, because you know yourself is much stronger. So I love that connection you're making for all of us.
This is awesome, Brent. Well, thank you so much. And until next time, let's go make it a great day.
It's thanks to help from listeners like you, this podcast can continue to grow and help others. If you found anything helpful in today's episode, please take a second, share with a friend, and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast today. Thanks.